Oral History Interview, Legends and Pioneers of Blindness Assistive Technology, Ted Henter, St. Petersburg, Florida, Interviewer Tony Candela, April 30th, 2004. Ted Henter, in his younger days, never would have believed that someday he would be blind. He was a surfer, a championship motorcycle racer, an engineer who didn't always like to work, and someone who was finding his way in the world and making his way to the very top of the motorcycle racing industry when a car accident took his sight. Ted received some initial training in how to use a talking terminal from Dean Blasey and Maryland Computer Services, who later hired him to represent that product. Then Ted struck out on his own and with a silent partner, Bill Joyce, formed the company Henter Joyce, which along with Dean Blasey's company eventually folded into Freedom Scientific. But in the interim, in the 1980s and 1990s, Ted Henter made history. He invented the speech software package JAWS, Job Access with Speech, by far the most widely disseminated and best known synthetic speech software package on the market. In fact, some would argue that JAWS has become generic for speech software, although makers of other software packages might argue with that. After Ted developed JAWS, the Windows Revolution came upon us, and undaunted, Ted and his team of very skillful engineers continued to manufacture the speech software, modified it, rebuilt it so that it would function with the Windows operating system, and to the relief of many blind people in this country, talking computers continued to work, but now in a Windows environment, using the graphical user interface for people without vision, was made possible largely through the work of Ted Henter. Born and raised in the Panama Canal Zone, Ted has lived a wonderful and adventurous life. He's still an active athlete. He loves to water ski, and I'm sure you'll find his story as fascinating as I did. Ted continues to work. We interviewed in his home office in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is also the headquarters of his newest company, which he runs with his daughter, Emily, called Henter Math. Ted's attention is now turned toward making sure that visually impaired children and youth have the best chance they can to get a good education in mathematics and sciences in order to enter careers that have been, up until now, out of reach for many of them. With the virtual pencil, they'll be able to handle all sorts of mathematical formulas, from the most simple of algebraic equations to eventually calculus and beyond. Ted, thank you very much for agreeing to do this oral history interview with me. We're sitting in your lovely home in St. Petersburg, Florida. I've met your wife, Mel, and I've met your daughter, Emily. Tell me a bit about your family, and then I'll ask you to tell me what you are doing these days, but tell me a bit about your family.
Well, Mel was my high school girlfriend, and we dated for about 7 or 8 years and got married when we were 25, and that was 28 years ago. So, and then along the way we've had 3 girls, 23, 21, and 12, Emily, Elizabeth, and Amber. The 2 older girls are in college. Emily is actually working for Henter Math as well. And Amber is in the 6th grade and is competitive at horse shows. Her and Mel do a lot of horse shows. And Mel also rides horses and does shows. And Emily rides too and does shows. But Amber, her goal is to go to the Olympics as a hunter jumper. So we're pretty busy with that, those kind of activities.
So she'll be a Henter hunter.
Yeah. And when the older girls were growing up, we did a lot of water skiing because we've always been in the boats and lived near the water. So all three girls are pretty good water skiers. Lately we've done some snow skiing. Elizabeth has a black belt in karate. Emily was a cheerleader in high school. And Elizabeth is currently on the basketball team at Milligan College, which is a small Christian school up in Johnson City, Tennessee. So she's in her third year there. Emily's got about 3 years of college also, but has taken time out to work and doing a little bit of each, actually.
What is she studying?
Marketing. Marketing and business administration.
Ah, excellent. Excellent. And you mentioned Emily working with you at Henter Math. Henter Math is your newest venture. It's what you're doing now. Can you tell us a bit about Henter Math?
Yep. Back in the late 90s, I was helping Emily with her algebra homework from junior high school, and I could see the problem in my head, but I couldn't communicate to her what it looked like. I couldn't write it down. And I realized for the first time how difficult math is for someone who's blind or someone who can't operate a pencil or someone who's motor impaired or maybe learning disabled. Because I have a college degree in engineering, but I got it when I was sighted because I wasn't blind until I was 27 years old. Mm-hmm. And so I got this idea for doing math on the computer and applied for a patent on it and was working on it a little bit at Henter Joyce before we sold to Freedom Scientific. But we were pretty busy with JAWS in those days, and we were very busy. And I couldn't get enough people at the company interested in doing the math project. So when I left Freedom Scientific a few years ago, I bought the rights to this product from the company, because Freedom Scientific owned it once they bought Henter Joyce, because Henter Joyce had owned the rights to the product and the patent. But I got it back from them, and all along with the intention of doing this. I was going to do it at Freedom Scientific, but it didn't work out there. They were also too busy to take on a new project. So we started this company in January of 2002. We hired Jeff Diddle, who's an experienced programmer and a JAWS user. And so he's our chief technical officer and does all the programming, at least the great majority of it. And we're developing math software. We currently have a product that does arithmetic and fractions. So a blind person or someone who's motor impaired or learning disabled can use our software to do these types of problems, arithmetic or fractions, work through the problem, print it out, hand it in, emboss it to review in class later, whatever. There's a lot of benefits to it, which I'll go in if we have the time. Mm-hmm. And at this point in time, the spring of 2004, we have a version that does algebra, which we're about to release for beta testing, and we hope to have that on the market by the end of the summer.
Excellent. Excellent.
And actually, that's just the start, because math is such a huge subject. We'll be moving on from here to do the higher levels of math, like trigonometry and calculus, and then into other areas of engineering and science, like physics, chemistry, engineering. All those high school and college type things that require equations and solving equations.
Mm-hmm. And it's done with people at a keyboard, at a computer.
Yep.
So the math pencil is not a real pencil. It's a
Correct.
Virtual pencil.
It's a virtual pencil. That's the name of it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, use the keyboard, or if you can't use the keyboard, use alternative input devices to operate the computer. Mm-hmm. And let's say if you're blind, the teacher, a sighted teacher, can create the problems, print them out for the sighted kids in class, email them or hand them out on disk to the blind kid or kids. The blind student can sit there in class or in the computer lab and work through the problems in real time, about the same time the other kids do, and then hand them back in, email them or on disk or whatever, or print them out. And they print them out and the sighted teacher can see them. No special skill involved as far as Braille goes. If the blind student wants to use Braille, then if you have a Braille display on the computer, you can use that. Of course, you can emboss it so you can look it over in class. But the idea is however you operate the computer, you can do the math on the computer. And it saves a lot of time in the classroom and you don't have to have the translation from print to Braille and then back. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of advantages. Plus, you can do it at home. You know, you can download the problems or the tests from the internet or get them in email. There's tutor mode and test mode. A lot of advantages of doing it this way. I think it's analogous to 20 years ago, people were still using a fountain pen or a typewriter to write letters. Mm-hmm. But nobody does that anymore. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of advantages of using the computer.
And this will open up doors. Kids who know they have the tool, who may have had the talent in the past but not tried, will now try because they know they have the tool.
Exactly. So many blind kids, and I'm sure kids with other disabilities, they kind of hit the wall when they get out of elementary school and into high school or junior high. You get to algebra, and then you realize, well, I better change my major because it's so difficult to do math and science if you can't see. The materials just aren't there. Even when they publish math and science, it's not accessible. Now, it is becoming accessible thanks to things like MathType. Mm-hmm. And MathML, and the screen readers are stepping up. But what our product will do, Virtual Pencil, we hope, is to smooth the way so kids can stay with what they're interested in, with math and science, have a reasonable experience in high school, open up a lot of opportunities, you know, different choices in their college career, and then, of course, in their careers themselves, their vocational career. We hope that this product and others like it will just open up a whole bunch of different opportunities for disabled kids.
Your approach has always been, correct me if I'm wrong, one of enabling blind people to operate in the mainstream. The alternative philosophy would be, always to operate in the mainstream, but the technologies being more proprietary or more standalone and more blindness oriented per se. But your approach with what you have and your companies have developed through the years has always been to stay as close to the mainstream as possible. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. See, when I was blinded in a car accident, of course it happened real quick, and I had absolutely no experience with blindness or blind friends or anything. So I was there, I was a young guy, about 27 years old, had a college degree, and what I wanted more than anything was to get a job. Once I gave up on the idea of recovering my eyesight, the next best thing was to get a job. And that's always been my focus, you know, is developing products like JAWS that people can use on the job. And of course, when I got my first job, I went to work in an office as a programmer, because I had to go back to the school and learn how to be a programmer. I got my first job as a programmer. I had to use the same software that the other people were using. Mm-hmm. And I began, you know, I just kind of, it's pretty obvious that that's what you want access to, is the same software everybody else is using. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've always felt is very important, so that a blind person can fit right in with everybody else in the office, you know. And that usually means everybody else is sighted.
So your experience then was from the point of view of, first, I guess, going to college as someone who now had no eyesight, and then functioning on the job. And yep. hence the name Job Access with Speech.
Yeah.
You were job-oriented.
True. And in those days, too, that was the main focus. That's, besides my own experience, wanting to be able to function with quote, regular, unquote, software, that was also the big push, was to get jobs for blind people, and that's where the money was. There was money available to buy technology. So that's just always been really been the focus. It's not until recently that I began to see that, well, now there's a real problem with education as well. So I'm learning about that. But you mentioned job access with speech. That just kind of there's an interesting story there, Tony, as long as we're on the history part.
Sure.
Jack Gilson, who's an old friend of mine and lots of other people in this field, lives in Atlanta. He and I were driving along one day in Georgia somewhere, and this is when we were first developing JAWS, but we didn't have a name for it yet. And at that point in time, must have been 1987, or maybe 88, early 88, there was a product on the market called Dolphin, which was a DOS screen reader. Mm-hmm. And so we were just goofing around, and the movie Jaws was big then, the shark, you know. And so we said, so I said, hey, how about Jaws? And he said, Dolphin. And so we laughed, and then I think it was that same trip, maybe shortly thereafter, I figured out it could stand for Job Access with Speech. But nobody liked that name at first. When I told people about the name, nobody liked it. That was a dumb name. But it took about 3 or 4 weeks, and it just kept growing on me, and I decided, yeah, this is a really good name, so we're going to go with this. But it was Jack Gilson, and I goofing around that we came up with that.
And so there's a Florida connection here, obviously.
Yep.
With Jaws, I believe, took place in Florida, and you were in Florida, I guess, at that time.
Well, I think originally it was up in New York, the movie. Montauk Point or something like that in New York. But I think they've had some, sequels in the Bahamas and things like that.
I stand corrected, but I'm glad the acronym followed the name. Usually people force these things, so that's funny. It's a great story.
It's one of those things that have happened, and I hope we can get into this as we talk. It's one of those things that has happened to me throughout my career that are just, you know, positive things that just happen. We didn't plan on it. We didn't work at it. It just happened. There's been a lot of things like that in my career, so I've had a very blessed life in that sense. That good things have happened. A few bad things, too, but mostly good. And even at that point in time, I don't realize how good they are, but down the road you can see, yep, this was a good thing that happened, and this caused this, and this caused this, and then we did this, and it ended up to be really good stuff.
And being able to notice it while it's happening and going with it is of course, very important, too.
Mm-hmm.
Ted, let's go back in time and work our way forward a little bit, and I'll get you to tell us a whole bunch of inspiring stories as we go along, and we'll talk about how happenstance plays into things, and as you see a good thing happening, realizing it and going with it. Let's talk about your parents. What are their names, and where were they from originally?
My father's named Ted, and he was born and raised in the Panama Canal Zone, as I was, because my grandfather came over from Hungary at the turn of the century to help dig the Panama Canal. He operated a steam shovel and was a mechanic and did repairs down there and lived there all his life. So my dad was born and raised there from 1910 to 1971 when he moved to the States. My mom is named Emily, E-M-L-E-Y, hence the name of my daughter. And her background is from England. She came born and raised in New Jersey, born in New Jersey, moved to the Panama Canal Zone when she was very young, about 2 years old. So both mom and dad were raised in Panama, and so was my wife and I.
How did your mom end up moving to the Panama Canal Zone?
Well, back then, you know, like the 1914, there was a war going on, and they were hiring people like crazy in Panama to at that point finish up the canal and to maintain it. So my mom's father went down there to work. There was a lot of Americans being hired to go down there, you know, skilled workers, the tradesmen and whatnot. And so that's how he got down there. A lot of people were hired from the States to go there. Because mm-hmm. in Panama, you know, it was a province of Colombia. There was very little civilization there at the turn of the century. And the Americans went in there and put in the sewage system and the electrical system and built the buildings and pretty much brought civilization to that country. Hmm. Up until then, it was just a swampy, filthy, dirty spot in between North America and South America, full of diseases and illnesses. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on down there at the turn of the century and in the first two decades. Mm-hmm. Building the canal and cleaning up the countryside and curing malaria and yellow fever. You know, that's where they discovered, between there and Cuba, they discovered that mosquitoes carried malaria and yellow fever, and they eradicated the mosquitoes, or at least the type that carry those diseases. Big project.
And then somewhere along the way, your dad met your mom.
Yeah. Gee, I forget what it was. I think it was in school. My dad was 2 years older than she was, and they got married in 1936 when their dad was about 25. Dad was 25. Yep, and then I'm an only child. I was born in 1950, but I had a lot of cousins. Born in 1950, in the Canal Zone, Panama Canal Zone, born and raised down there. And that was like a part of the U.S. Growing up, I didn't realize I was in a foreign country. Of course, it takes a while before you figure out where you are geographically. But everybody spoke English. It was mostly Americans. We had our own schools and courts and restaurants and commissaries. So it was very little exposure to Panama until I got to be like a late teens and started venturing out into the country and going surfing and things like that.
So as a child, your world was somewhat circumscribed by the Americanization that was going on.
Yeah, Americanization, but very rural. Even though it was like a piece of America plopped down there, it was small town America. A lot of small towns, you could walk to school, ride your bike to school, very safe and secure, but almost no crime. It was wonderful, as most pla a lot of places were back in the 50s and 60s, but it was great. But also there was so much jungle and wilderness around us that we were always out in the jungle, going on hikes. I was in the Boy Scouts, camping trips, going water skiing, going surfing. We'd go away to the beach like 60 miles away, even though we lived right on the water. And the surfing beaches were 60 miles away. We'd go up there for the weekend, leave high school on a Friday afternoon, not don't come back home till Sunday night, sleep on the beach. It was great. It was a terrific way to live.
And this would and your teen years for you were early to mid 60s, we'll say. Mid
Yeah.
60s, a little bit into the late 60s.
Right.
So this and we'll come back and talk more about that because those were interesting times in general.
Yeah.
Do you think looking back on it now that that your world was sheltered in any way or in some way that you were out of the mainstream?
Yeah, out of the mainstream. Like we had no interest in professional sports, for example. Very few of my friends grew up wanting to be like a baseball player, a football player, that sort of thing. My friends were all focused on surfing, but then later on I got into motorcycle racing because we had a lot of folks doing motorcycle racing down there and riding in the woods and stuff like that. So it was a lot different than growing up here from what I see now. Of course, now it's a lot later in time. Things may have been the same in a small U.S. town back in the 60s.
In what I'm imagining that the land and the terrain was, how does motorcycle racing flourish down there? Are there lots of places to ride?
Yeah, there's a lot of places to ride. There's bare, undeveloped jungle, which is tough to ride through, but you can do it. There are some plains. And then we just had there was a lot of land that was cultivated. I mean, not for farming, but the trees have been cut down and made nice landscapes and things like that. Because a lot of the area at either end of the canal is man-made. It was just a big old swamp. And when they dug the canal, they had to remove a lot of dirt for one thing. And what they did was they dump it in the ocean and build up the land. So in fact, where I lived and went to school, my first 18 years was all in this fill. And we didn't know it at the time because it looks like a real nice neighborhood with trees and grass and everything, but back in 1900 it was just a swamp. So there's a lot of this type of area around, so we could stake out a spot and set up a racetrack for motocross. And we had a club and we went racing. And then we also, there was things like World War II airfields. There was probably six airfields that had built during World War II that were now abandoned, just a piece of pavement out in the middle of nowhere. And so we could have motorcycle races and car races on those types of things. So it was really, really a cool place to be.
How old were you when you got on your first bike?
I think I was 15, my first motorcycle. But I've been a racing nut since I was about 6 years old. I got a go-kart when I was six. Christmas Day, and I got a policeman down the road stopped me and took me home. And when I was around 10 or 11, I was racing go-karts. I was reading all the magazines about cars and motorcycles and everything I'd get my hands on. Mm-hmm. So when I got my first motorcycle at the age of 15, I, you know, started taking off the muffler and things like that to make it go faster, or at least to make it louder. Mm-hmm. So I was always interested in that kind of stuff. And my dad was a natural. He was a, even though he was a civil engineer, he just did a lot of mechanical work, you know, as a hobby. Always working on boats and jeeps and stuff like that. So we had a well-equipped shop in the under the house. So I learned how to use tools at an early age. I was always working on my bicycle. Mm-hmm. In fourth grade, I took apart the coaster brake on a bike and put it back together, which amazed my dad. Just stuff like that. So I was a natural mechanic. So when I got my motorcycle, I started working on them. And that's why when I went to college, I became a mechanical engineer. My goal was to design racing cars. And but I got so involved in the racing, motorcycle racing myself, that I never got to that point in my career.
Do you remember, or can you describe the first go-kart that you had, or any of the go-karts? How were they constructed?
Yeah, the first one we got from Sears. It was a very flimsy thing with a little, like a lawnmower motor on it, with a belt drive, very skinny tires. It was one round tube running from front to back with all the things bolted to that, you know, seat and the motor and all that stuff. Very flimsy, but very cheap and great for just bopping around in the backyard for a six-year-old, you know. Mm-hmm. But then as I progressed, the go-karts back then looked a lot like they do now, you know, four wheels, motor in the back, gas tank in the front. They haven't changed much as far as overall dimensions and just looking at them, but the technology in go-karts today is really amazing. Like most things are, because we did race a little. I raced, you know, back in the 60s. Just recently, my daughter Elizabeth was into go-kart racing, and so we went racing. I think from about 97 to that must have been like 95 to 2000. We raced go-karts here in the States, which is a much higher level, much more sophisticated equipment, mm-hmm. a lot more competition.
So this runs in the family?
To a certain extent, yeah. Yeah, Elizabeth isn't racing now. She retired when she got out of high school. But she loved to go motorcycle racing. We did go to a motorcycle racing school at Road Atlanta, the Schwantz School. Kevin Schwantz is a former world champion. Mm-hmm. You can go to a two-day school up there and learn how to road race, and that was terrific. Because I raced at that same racetrack back in the 70s, so... When I was at this school last fall with my daughter Elizabeth and my friend Dan Moore, I got on the back of one of these bikes with one of the instructors and went around the racetrack at high speed, up to 135 miles an hour down the straightaway.
Oh my
so
goodness.
It was quite a thrill. It was pretty scary, too.
Did you ever have any accidents on your go-kart or on your motorcycles?
Plenty.
Plenty?
Plenty of accidents. Not so much on the go-kart. I was go-karts, you know, you don't fall off a go-kart like you do a motorcycle. Mm-hmm. They spin out, and if you're not careful, you might hit something. But so I didn't really get hurt on my go-kart, but I've had about 10 broken bones from my motorcycle racing. I cracked a vertebrae in my neck when I crashed at Laguna Seca out in California in 73. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I broke a collarbone, a wrist, and an ankle.
Ouch.
So I was out of action for a while. I was in a body cast and all that stuff. Prior to that, back in the 60s, I broke my left femur. So I was out of action. I missed a semester of high school, junior in high school. So I've broken my other collarbone. I've broken my other wrist. I've broken my ankles three times, a couple of ribs, a couple of fingers.
Did any of this make you think about stopping?
Yeah. Oh yeah, in my early 20s, you know, I demonstrated a lot of potential. I was on the pole at Daytona for one of the big races. I got a second at Talladega. This is the what they call the International Expert class, the highest category of road racing. And so I was I was having some success, but at that point in time, there was very little money involved in motorcycle racing. Because remember, in the early 70s was the oil crisis, the first one. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot of money involved in recreational activities, recreational vehicle activities. So we were all struggling and just not making a lot of money. But as I got older, I got a little bit smarter, and I quit falling off my bike as much. I also got a little bit more timid, I think it's safe to say, and started thinking about these injuries, because the older you get, the slower you heal, the more it hurts, and the more you think about it. So I was kind of getting towards the end of my career at the age of 27. I began to realize, you know, the time is running out. I got to make this thing happen. And so, yeah, I could definitely see the end was in sight. And that's why I went to, made up my mind to go into the World Championship that year in 78. So I was actually in eighth place in the World Championship at the time I was blinded.
Uh-huh. And that was over in Europe, if I remember.
Yeah, in England.
Were you always an athletic kid, or were you an athletic kid when you were growing up?
No, I wouldn't claim that. I was always pretty active. You know, I've been water skiing since I was 5 years old. And I played Little League baseball and stuff like that, but I was not a good baseball player. I did not play football or basketball. I wasn't good at that. But I went for the weird things, well, the different things, because back in 1962 or 3, I started surfing, and that was, you know, a new thing back then. So no, I wasn't really athletic, and I wasn't good at those team sports, but I was a pretty good surfer and a pretty good water skier, and then a pretty good motorcycle racer.
What kind of skills do you have to be a good surfer?
Balance is important, and eye-hand coordination is important. You don't really use your hands, but use your feet. But I think surfing is a lot like motorcycle racing. You have to be able to understand where you are on the wave and where you're going to be in the next second or two or three, and where the wave is going to be. It's just like motorcycle racing. You look at a racetrack, and okay, you turn left, you turn right, that's not a big deal. But to find your way around the track quickly, you have to take the proper line. So you have to position yourself in the right spot at each instant in time. Mm-hmm. And you have to anticipate when to brake, you know, when to put on the gas, because you don't brake when you get to the turn. If you're going 180 miles an hour like you do at Daytona, you've got to start braking way ahead of that. Mm-hmm. And so your positioning in your environment is so important in surfing and in racing. Mm-hmm. And your sense of speed, not only your position, but where you are now, but where you're going to be in 2 seconds from now.
Mm-hmm. And for riding motorcycles, did you have to have a lot of upper body strength for that?
No, not really. Now motocross, it certainly does help, but I wasn't a great motocross racer. My favorite and where I did the best was road racing. The real streamlined bikes where you lean way over and drag your knees on the ground, that sort of thing. Uh-huh. Well, you don't probably know what I'm talking about, but people that can see, well, I've seen it on TV and seen pictures where the bikes lean way over and they have a streamlined shell on them and the rider can tuck behind the windshield. Mm-hmm. That was my favorite. They're the fast ones, because even back then in the 70s, we were doing 180 miles an hour at Daytona and Talladega, you know, the big tracks. But it wasn't upper body strength so much as endurance was important, of course, because in a 200-mile race, it might take 2 hours. You're in a leather suit. It's 105 degrees on the racetrack in the sun. So it can get to you.
Mm. And you obviously went to school in the Panama Canal Zone. What types of schools were available?
Well, it was your typical elementary school, junior high, and high school, really. And then we had a junior college. No, that was about it. So we had a very good public school education, a very good high school education. And I had a natural affinity for math and science, so I took some of those courses, advanced courses in high school. And so it was just a wonderful place to grow up, a great childhood.
Were you a good student, an attentive student?
Yeah, I was. I took school very seriously. I think, you know, being an only child, my mom and dad were both, quote, professionals, unquote. You know, they'd always raised me with a sense that it was important to do good in school, to be respectful to your teachers, to succeed at whatever you, or at least try to succeed at whatever you're involved in. And whether you like it or not, you're going to college. Just kind of got that from mom and dad. So yeah, I definitely paid attention in school. I was well-behaved, respectful, and I got good grades. You know, I got a B average in high school, not a straight-A student, but because I was also not totally focused exclusively on schoolwork. You know, I was involved in the after-school activities like surfing and riding motorcycles and hanging around with girls and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
Now, your dad was an engineer. Did he have a college degree?
No, not a degree. He had some college, but he did have an engineering license, and he was a member of the professional engineers, but no actual degree. Because in his day, you know, back in the 20s and 30s when he went to college, it wasn't such a big deal then. So. No, he didn't have a formal degree.
How about your mom? What was her education?
I don't think she had any formal education beyond high school.
Mm-hmm. And she worked as a professional?
As a legal secretary, uh-huh. And an office administrator, things like that.
So when you came home from school, were they generally... there or not there in your younger days?
In the younger days, yeah. Mom was there, and Dad would get off work at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon and be home, uh-huh. And we'd always be tinkering on something in the under the house. I hesitate to say basement because it wasn't underground. It was, most of the houses were built off the ground, so under the house was like just an open area where you could have like a hobby shop. So Dad was always tinkering on, you know, the boat or the outboard motor or the Jeep. We had a Jeep, and so I was frequently helped him, or he'd help me with my bicycle and stuff like that. So I had a lot of parental involvement.
And when did they make you do your homework?
After dinner in the evenings. Uh-huh. In Panama, it gets dark at 6 o'clock every day year round, and we would eat at 5:30 in the afternoon, no matter what. That was dinner time. Uh-huh. So after school, you got to go out and play, but I had to be home at 5:30 to eat, and then do homework.
Mm-hmm. And what time did you go to bed at night when you were young?
Oh gosh, I don't even remember, you know, but it wasn't very late, I'm sure of that.
Did you watch a lot of TV?
No, there really was no TV. I mean, we, in the 60s, we had a television in the house, but there was nothing on. It was the Armed Forces Radio and Television Service. And I don't think it even came on till about 6 o'clock at night, and then you'd get 5 minutes of news, which I never watched. The neatest thing about TV in the Canal Zone, well, that's what we called it, the Canal Zone, was the Andy Griffith Show, which that came on once a week, and that was about it. So, you know, I spent 1 hour a week, maybe, watching TV.
Mm-hmm. When you started becoming aware of world events, going to guess, let's just say most kids start to think about these things in their teen years. Vietnam War was just beginning. The Cold War was on for a while. Things there were pressures in the world that if you were around television a lot, you'd see manifestations of them. Do you recall those years being aware of what was going on in the rest of the world?
Yeah, we were quite aware of the Russians in the Cold War because we always had those bomb drills, you know?
Air raid drills.
The air raid drills, and you had to get under your desk. don't get near the windows and stuff like that. Yeah, so we had that. Plus, in the Panama Canal Zone, there was about 10,000 civilians, including kids, you know, families. Uh-huh. And there was about 50,000 U.S. military. There was about 10 U.S. military bases. So we were surrounded by the military. In fact, the U-2 spy plane would fly right over our high school in the early 60s. I guess it was the mid-60s when I was in high school. I remember sitting there, you know, in the afternoons, kind of daydreaming, looking out the window, and shoo, right over the high school comes the U-2 landing, because the airstrip was maybe 2 miles away. Mm-hmm. And if you got up early enough in the morning, you could see the U-2 take off if you were quick, because those things take off real quick. And then in later years, it was the SR-71, the Blackbird. So we were surrounded by the military, and then, of course, our older friends were getting drafted and things like that. So, and there was jungle training there. In fact, my dad was involved with setting up the jungle training course for the U.S. military. There was all kinds of, each year they would have military maneuvers where they'd fly like 100 planes with paratroopers down from the bases in the U.S., fly them down to Panama, parachute out. So we'd go up into what we call the interior of Panama, which is like 60, 70 miles out of the city up near where we surfed, and watch the paratroopers come in and paratroop out and all that stuff. So yeah, we were quite aware of what was going on.
That must have been an amazing sight, all these little dots in the sky. Is that what it looked like?
It is fantastic. And sometimes, as I recall, there would be maybe 1,000 parachutes in the air at one time. Just amazing. Wow. Quite impressive, too.
Is that how they looked? Do they start out looking like barely perceptible things up there and slowly come into view? How do you remember it looking?
These drops were at fairly low altitude, so you could pretty clearly see the planes, and as soon as the guys would jump out of the plane, the chute would be pulled. So they were bigger than dots, but but many times the guy up high would be hidden by a guy down lower. You know, you couldn't see them all. It was just packed with. The sky would be full of parachutes. Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing.
Do you remember any military accidents happening while you were growing up? Anything unpredictable or dangerous because of all that military around you?
No, nothing like that. Of course, you know, you get 50,000 U.S. troops, you got 40,000 wild and crazy young men. So there was always car accidents, motorcycle accidents, that kind of stuff. Fights. But I can't think of any what you'd call a military accident. I'm sure there were, you know, there were happening all the time, but not in view, so to speak.
So your childhood and teen years doesn't have explosions and bombs and things like that as part of your memory.
No, okay. not accident. But also that there was also a lot of firing ranges around where you could go out and watch them shoot the big cannons and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, we experienced all kinds of stuff like that, but as spectators.
I see. Was there a time along the way in your growing up years where you had a sense of what you might do for a career? Did you decide early on what you might do, become an engineer?
Yeah, I did. In the mid-60s, I thought I wanted to be an airline pilot. But as I got more and more into motorcycle racing, I decided I wanted to be a race car designer. And Formula One racing was my favorite. That's the world championship for cars. And that's like the top level of car racing. And so it was always my goal to get an engineering degree and go to England and build race cars, design race cars.
Why England?
That's where it's done. Uh-huh. Even back then and even today, I think it's safe to say all the Formula One teams, and that includes like Ferrari, which is an Italian team, and Renault, which is a French team, Toyota, which is a Japanese team, mm-hmm. the cars are actually built in England. Huh. It's like a cottage industry, and that's where all the experts have migrated to, and all the skilled craftsmen and designers, because these are very specialized automobiles.
So the image of the shapes of cars and the aerodynamics and the engines on the inside, everything, I guess, was part of what you aspired to be involved in.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I went through a typical 4-year college degree, a bachelor's. So you don't specialize at all there. You just got to get the basics out of the way. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I was also quite involved in motorcycle racing while I was going to college and then after college. So I never really got into the real serious race car design stuff.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go to college?
I did my last 2.5 years at the University of Florida in Gainesville. My first year I did the Inglewood No, wait a minute. Northrop Institute of Technology, which is in Inglewood, California, uh-huh. part of L.A. It's right by the L.A. airport. Uh-huh. It was a small private school that they teach airplane mechanics and a little bit of engineering. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it at the time, but it was a mistake to go there for me.
Why?
So I spent a year there, then I went back to Canal Zone, did a year of junior college, then I went to the University of Florida. Uh-huh. Well, the school in California was a very small school. Most of the people there were getting a license to be aircraft mechanics. So there was not a lot of engineering and not a lot of the kind of stuff I was interested in.
The Northrop is famous for making airplane engines.
Yeah.
The Northrop engine is well known.
Yeah.
So you realized that becoming a mechanic was not your aspiration. Becoming a true engineer was your aspiration.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, you would have graduated high school, let's just guess, 1966, 67?
69.
Okay. And you would have turned draft age right
yep.
around this time, and for sure we were in the absolute height of the Vietnam War right
yeah.
at this time. So were you afraid of getting drafted?
Yeah, that was a concern. In those days, it had never been my desire to go in the military. It wasn't part of the family, and things like that. Now I'm sorry that I missed that experience, because some of my friends have done it. It was an excellent experience. And I'm sorry that I wasn't more proactive in getting involved with the military. Of course, the Vietnam War was, pretty unpopular. And in high school, I had a high school deferment. When I went to college, I had the college deferment for a while. Mm-hmm. I think it was 69 or 70 when they came out with the lottery for the draft. Mm-hmm. So I got a high lottery number, and so I didn't get drafted. Mm-hmm. So I was able to continue my college career, and then after that, when I got out of college in 74, the war was over, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So... yeah, I miss the Vietnam War, and I wish that I had had some of those experiences. Of course, it's quite dangerous and all those types of things, but hindsight is always different.
Well, I guess it's safe to say that you were and still are a daredevil. Because, looking back on it, you can still say that you might have been willing to take that risk.
Yeah. And I think I would have been really good at flying a fighter airplane or a helicopter gunship or something like that. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of my good friends is a helicopter gunship pilot, and he's got some great stories. Uh-huh. But, it's not that it's fun to go over and kill people, but it's a patriotic thing to do to be in the military. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite, I'm quite proud of the fellows that are over there fighting the war now, and I pray for them every day. Mm-hmm. And even though, they have a job to do, and they're doing it very well. Unfortunately, some of them aren't coming back alive. That's the downside.
Yeah.
And some of my friends from the 60s didn't come back either. And some of them came back with lifelong injuries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My friend Donnie Dunn, who became a friend just 10 years ago, after the war and after his injuries and all, he's blind and a double amputee. Great guy. He did tech support for us on JAWS, uh-huh. and now he's doing tech support for us on Virtual Pencil.
Oh,
really, really great guy. But he was injured in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and I have other friends too that have not recovered from their injuries. But I was fortunate in that respect that I did not get drafted. On the other hand, I'm missing something because I didn't go, which I regret.
Do you think you realized this at the time?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So you didn't spend time consciously aware of compensating for not having gone. You weren't thinking those terms back then.
No, I was totally focused on racing. My career, what I thought was going to be a career in designing race cars, but in the meantime, I was racing motorcycles, and I had a career going there, so I was very focused on that, and going in the military was just the last thing I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And the people I was around, we were all thinking pretty much the same way. Because we did not grow up with military in a military family or with friends in the military. Like, even my dad back in World War II, working down in Panama, the Panama Canal was such an important thing to have for the U.S. military to get the ships from the Atlantic to the Pacific and vice versa. Mm-hmm. The people down there weren't even allowed to go in the war, some of them, like my dad. His job was too important in 1941, 42. Mm-hmm. His job on the canal was just too important. They couldn't let him go in the military. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we just didn't have that heritage in our family.
I see. When do you recall contacting your first computer or computer-like device?
It was my first year of college, 1969. Out there at Northrop Institute of Technology, we had a computer there, and we were doing Fortran. Of course, being an engineering school, that's what you do. So that was my first experience with computers. Totally different from what it's like today.
What were they like?
I don't recall ever seeing the computer. You know, it was it was somewhere else. It was on campus, but it was in this room or that room. I don't think I ever actually saw the computer. And we had punch cards. And so you had a little machine like a typewriter, and you stick these cards in it, and you would write your program, and it would just punch holes in the card. And when you had enough of these cards, it'd make a stack maybe a half inch high or maybe 5 inches high. Mm-hmm. And they were bigger than playing cards. They're probably twice the size of playing cards. Mm-hmm. And then you had to keep them all in order, of course, because you stuck them in a card reader and it read them in order, and then that was the information that was your computer program. Mm-hmm. Quite bizarre compared to these days. But that's the way it was done.
Mm-hmm. Were you fascinated by the computer or doing computer work?
No. No, to me it was just one more hassle. I had to get a good grade in to keep on moving up in my college. It was just one of those things, like operating a slide rule, you know, like learning calculus. Oh, I got to do this, so I sat down and learned how to do it. Mm-hmm. But I had no clue how important it all was going to be someday.
Mm-hmm. And so this computer for you started out as just another one of the tools.
Yep, just something else you had to learn how to operate. Mm-hmm. I didn't grasp, you know, all the significance of how important it would be, even if I became a race car designer. You know, I didn't grasp all that. It was just, this is what's in front of me now, and this is what I got to get through mm-hmm. to get a passing grade. Uh-huh. In those days, you know, I didn't think very far ahead, and I don't think very far ahead these days either. I just deal with what's obviously the problem mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm.
What do you think made it so hard? What made you not think ahead back then, and maybe not think ahead too much now?
Well, I didn't spend a lot of time in those days sitting around thinking, well, gosh, what's life going to be like 10 years from now? You know, I was real busy living life as it was right then, so I don't recall having any strategic planning sessions, so to speak, you know. And even today... Well, even in my career in assistive technology, a lot of things just happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I've had several strategic planning sessions, but after about 6 months, you kind of throw them away because it's just not working out the way you thought it was going to. But, you know, those things are important for business. You got to look ahead, and smarter guys than me have insisted that we look ahead, you know, for business plans and mm-hmm. stuff. So I have been involved in that, but it's never been an interest of mine or something I've been particularly good at.
And the way the growth of technology has accelerated through the years, being able to move as the industry moved or as the needs emerged, probably has held you in good stead.
Yeah. Yeah, see, in assistive technology, well, see, it's not like... Well, see, at Microsoft, they got guys that'll say, okay, what are we going to need 5 years from now? And they set a group of people aside, and they start working on it. And then they have other people that are taking care of today's problems and today's bugs and the virus attacks and the tech support calls and stuff like that. But at Hunter Joyce and prior to that at Maryland Computer Services, the phone would ring. We'd have a customer on the line that had a problem right now we had to solve. We didn't have time or resources to sit around and think, well, gee, what kind of product should we develop for the people 3 years from now, or 5 years from now, or 10 years from now. We are always faced with more problems than we could handle, more bugs than we could fix, more applications that wouldn't work with JAWS, more customers that needed help. Always had more of those than we could handle. Mm-hmm. So we never said, okay, let's take 20% of the development staff and get them working on the next generation. And that's part of the problem. We were very reactionary. But consequently, we focused on those problems and got them fixed. And that's one reason why JAWS is the most popular screen reader in the world today. Because we did jump on it as quickly as we could and focused on it. As opposed to saying, well, you know, let's wait 6 months to fix that bug because we're working on the problems that are going to happen 5 years from now. And it wasn't like that. We were always focused on the problems we got today. What really has influenced my computer career and JAWS career, so to speak, is I was like a natural born engineer or mechanic. So I learned how to I could figure out how things work, like mechanical things like engines and stuff, and I could see, you know, how they work, and so I understood a lot of that kind of technology. And I also, in my racing career, I was a brash, young, hothead, pretty arrogant when I got started. Of course, after a few months in the hospital and things like that, I started to realize, well, maybe there's people around that know more about this than I do. Maybe I should pay attention when they try to tell me. Because you get all kinds of free advice. The important thing is to figure out what's good and what's not good. So being a motorcycle racer kind of humbled me. So I began to learn, hey, I should start paying attention to what other people are saying. There's a lot of good stuff there. And being a natural-born mechanic or engineer helped me to figure out, you know, how to make things. So I think those two things are very important when I got into business.
Did you have trouble in college with your engineering studies? Did anything come hard to you?
No. I was a good student. I focused. I listened well in class. I could see well. I could read well. I'd always been a good reader because in the early days, I read all the magazines about cars and stuff. So I had no problem in college. I didn't get straight A's. I got, you know, 3.1 or 3.2 average. But I took all the hard engineering-type courses, you know, calculus and thermodynamics and fluid dynamics and all this stuff. All this stuff I can't even remember now. But no, college was relatively easy for me. And like I said, at the time I was doing a lot of motorcycle racing also, so I was doing some traveling and missing classes and things like that. So I was fortunate that I could get through school relatively easily.
Was it difficult getting your first job out of college?
No, that was pretty easy. I was racing motorcycles, so I didn't want a real job, but then I wasn't eating very well either, so I had to get a job. And actually, I learned quite a bit on that first job. I got a job as a, quote, engineer, unquote, with a phosphate fertilizer company here in Florida, CF Industries. And I didn't have a lot to do. Of course, they wanted me to do a lot, but I didn't know how to do it, and I didn't know exactly what they wanted, and I was kind of at a loss. Plus, I was focused on racing. That's all I really wanted to do. So I managed to waste a lot of time and still get paid for it. I look back on that, and I realize what a horrible employee I was. I was terrible. And because it was a big chemical plant. You could go out in the plant, all outdoors, and you'd get lost for hours. Nobody knew where you were, especially the boss. So I managed to waste a lot of time there and never really learned much and never really produced much for the company. And I look back on that as quite a learning experience. I also had a terrific boss named Wally Potts who sort of understood what I was doing. He gave me a lot of leeway to kind of learn and I'm sure he hoped I would grow into something productive for the company, but I never did. After about 10 months, the racing season was starting again, and I needed some time off. Of course, I wasn't supposed to get a week off until I'd been there a year, but he gave me a week off to go to Daytona and go racing. So in the race, I crashed, broke my wrist, broke a collarbone, I think, something like that. Anyway, I couldn't go back to work. So I called him and said, all right, we'll come back when you can. So a few weeks later, I come back to work. You know, I had a cast on my arm. And by now, him and his boss had figured out that this guy Hinter, he's just not cut out to be an engineer at a phosphate fertilizer plant. We got to get rid of him, but we don't want to fire him, you know, because then there's all kinds of problems. So what we'll do is we'll just give him some really, really unpleasant work to do. So that's what happened. I would have to work from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. in this plant, watching this conveyor, shutting it down every hour, tightening all the nuts and bolts, making sure it wasn't going to break. Because if it did break, the plant would get shut down for hours and mess things up big time. So it was a big responsibility. I knew if I went to sleep and the conveyor would break, so it was horrible. I hated it. After 2 weeks, I quit. Oh. And went back to motorcycle racing and just didn't eat as well as I had been. But I learned a lot at that plant about myself and about other employees.
Around what year is this?
74, 75.
So then what happened?
Went racing and was doing better. I got a sponsor, the audio outlet in Savannah, Georgia. Uh-huh. Roger Edmondson was the owner of the store, and he loved racing, and we became friends, and so him and his store sponsored me in my racing. And I wasn't on a big budget, so I didn't live very well. But I was doing what I loved doing, that was racing motorcycles.
And you were around 25 years old.
Yeah. And then I got married about that time, too, in 76. Got married. That put an extra strain on the budget, but by then I was actually doing pretty good racing and working at the hi-fi store that Roger owned. And the good news is my wife had a job, so things were going pretty well.
Well, tell us how you met Mel. Mel is Mary Elizabeth.
Yep.
How did you meet her? Where did you meet her?
Well, growing up in the Canal Zone, she grew up there too, so she was just one of those kids that was around. We actually met in elementary school. She went to the Catholic school, I went to the public school, so we didn't see a lot of each other, but we had mutual friends. And you know, she was around. Then one day in 68, you know, with the start of the second semester of our junior year of high school, we ended up sitting right next to each other in homeroom. It was a homeroom, it was mechanical drawing, and it was a big desk. And so we actually sat at the same desk in homeroom. But I was only there for a week because I broke my femur a week after that and was out of school for the rest of the year. But she would come and visit me in the hospital and things like that. So we, you know, it was one of those fortunate situations where now she wasn't just a skinny little girl and I was interested in playing, you know, a dodgeball. Uh-huh. And I was more interested in, she wasn't a skinny little girl anymore, and I was more interested in girls like her. Mm-hmm. So it worked out real good. When I got out of the hospital, I actually went to work on a tuna boat that summer. Because that was what kids did back then, is ship out, you know, down in Panama. Uh-huh. Tuna boats would come by, you could get a job on them for a couple weeks at a time. So I made some money, came back, and happened to see her sister leaving the movies one night. I said, hey, how's Mel doing? Say hi to her for me, et cetera, et cetera. So tell her I'll be at Timmy Lane's party on Saturday. So that was the start of our romance, I guess. We met up at the party, and things went on from there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went to different colleges. So were you separated a lot during those years?
Yeah, we were.